baby. And the girl said, well, he cried for a little bit, but pretty soon he fell asleep. So Frances went in, and she couldn't see the baby. And she pulled up the light. She looked out to see there had been some kidnappings, and she said, if there were any ladder or anything, nothing. Then she turned on the light, and she found the baby had gotten up and crying, had gotten up and held her this and that thing that had the screws, and he fell in between it, and it hung him. So he was dead. And all she did was, my baby is dead, my baby is dead. And Jim and Hodat ran after the girl who lived only next door to them. And the girl, when she heard that, she ran and slammed the door. And he said, what did you do to my baby? She said, well, I didn't do anything to him. He cried, but I thought that I just let him cry and put his in his stuff. Well, he was dead. Hmm. And 2 days later, they came up to Berkeley. And neither one were able to the same, you know.
Well, did Frances go on and develop a career of her own then?
Well, Frances was a secretary.
Uh-huh.
And she was very good at that. She always wanted something to do, always made money, even was selling magazines door to door. And she and Bernard both did it.
And then how about Carol Jean? What did she go into, Barbara?
Carol Jean, well, when she was interested in, she was really always interested. You see, I told you when she was 7 years old, she went to the Catholic Church, the Mass. She was interested in finding out what religion was. She had come to me, I think I told you that she said, the hearers all pray before going to bed. I'm going to begin praying too. I said, good, go ahead. So for 2 weeks, she kept it up, praying very ostentatiously. So one time, she came to me and said, Mama, have you noticed that I stopped praying? I said, why did you stop? She said, well, nothing is happening. I said, what did you want happening? Well, the things I was praying for, nothing happened. I said, well, do you pray only to get something? I said, well, she said, what do you pray for, just for nothing? What do you pray about? So I thought that it would be a waste of my time and nothing happened. So she never prayed again. And then when she went and heard more about the Catholic Church, she said, all right, that was different. She began reading very, very early. They all began reading early.
What
would
they read, Barbara?
Huh?
What would they read?
Well, Carol Jean, you know, first read the, you know, most of them, both Dorothy and I love the early novels by American women novelists, you know. Mm. Dorothy Canfield Fisher was our favorite. Mm. And they all read them, especially Dorothy and Carol Jean and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Dorothy Canfield, did you know?
Tell me about that.
Yes.
Nope.
So
they read fiction.
And then they would read, they were interested in history, too. They were very interested in history. And they were interested in the history of the other countries. Carol Jean, to this day, loves, when I was 13 years old, I saved every nickel I could, and I bought Dickens' History of England. You know, well, you know, it's rather inadequate. But just the same, Carol Jean poured over that until the... Some years ago, she said, Mama, do you mind if I take this? I know it means something to you. You saved every nickel and penny that you couldn't be bothered. I said, yes, I paid a quarter for it. And to this day, she looks up something, you know, in the child history of England.
Well, what was her plan? What was she going to do?
Well, her plan was, that, you see, she left the Communist Party at UCLA when she said she was leaving all that. And then she thought, we could use those things that were productive and good in our own society to pass. So she thinks it's important that people vote to use every instrument that they can, and that they should know something of what their legislature, what their president is doing. And she gets people to register. She sees if they go to vote. She sees that when any of them, congressmen or senators, are around, that they form a committee and go to tell them what they want done. and that they know what's going on. See, Dorothy and Richard think this is only the work of a liberal. Mm-hmm. And I get very angry when I hear that. Mm-hmm. I said, well, it's the work of a liberal that in some ways is more productive than what you're doing. At least right now, this is the only thing that she can influence.
Does she define herself as a socialist?
No, she isn't socialist.
So all of the children maintain that ideology.
Oh, yes.
And Bernard still would define himself?
No, not Bernard. Bernard says he doesn't because it failed so miserably. Mm-hmm. Look, if they, the socialists, where they have a right to live, they have no right to question have them. Mm-hmm. So he says it's fallen flat on its face. So he says he wants none of it.
Mm-hmm. But would he ideologically, would he?
I think ideologically he would. Mm-hmm. But right now he's so sure at the Soviet Union, the anti-Semitism and everything, that he feels he's free of all of it. It's another false god.
So Dorothy was the only one who maintained clear through.
That's right.
A kind of radical involvement then.
That's right.
You and Dorothy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, now Barbara, now Joe started getting sick when?
Joe started getting sick in 1928. He had terrible pain in his toe. He just suffered agony with it. When he was in Chicago at one of their conventions, he went to a doctor and they found he had carbuncles. Now, what I read afterward about diabetes, the first thing when anyone gets carbuncles, you look for diabetes. Now, the phone took him to a doctor there. He never mentioned anything. You never knew about it. So when he came back and went to Denver, in Denver his feet were so bad and his toe was so bad that he was just suffering agony. He went to see a Dr. Blackmore, and Dr. Blackmore is the first one who said, you have diabetes, and if you don't take care of yourself, I'll give you 2 years to live. Mm-hmm. And he lived exactly 2 months over what the doctor told him he would live in 2 years. And when he came, Bernard and Carol Jean had their tonsils removed by Dr. Nelson, who was one of the heads at the UC in Berkeley, from the Battle Creek, Michigan guys, you know, who put out the cereals and everything.
Oh, uh-huh.
And Dr. Nelson, the hospital there was at Santa Rosa,
mm-hmm.
Santa Helena there, and he performed the operation, took the time, and Joe was there too. So Dr. Nelson told Joe, he's all baloney, the doctor, that he should eat the food about Battle Creek. So instead of eating meat or anything, he pulled his dough and they made a kind of a vegetarian loaf. And he used to carry that around with him in addition to all the samples of cheese, which was crazy. And he told him, he examined him, and said he couldn't find anything very bad, and he was already dying of it.
Did he keep working up until he died then?
Yeah, he died. Well, he left Berkeley the 2 days before he died. He left Berkeley and went to Portland, stayed with my sister for 2 days, then he went to Seattle, and Bernard was there for the international labor defense, because he was engaged to Yetta Stromberg at that time. And so Bernard was with him, and he was so sick. I got the last letter he wrote. I got it after he was already dead. He said, I have been so sick, it took me an hour to travel a little over a mile and a half in the car. I don't know what's the matter with me, but I'm very, very sick. And Bernard and he had breakfast, and then they went up to his room and had kind of a spell. And Bernard tried to call the hospital, the guys at the hotel Fry in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't come right away, and pretty soon Joe was dying. So finally, Bernard took that telephone and said, if you don't come up here, God damn you to hell, I'll smash you down to hell. My father is dying. If you don't come right away. Then they came running up there with the doctor. But the doctor said there's just no more I can do. And so Joe said to say goodbye to Mama. Mm-hmm. That's what he said.
But Bernard was with him then?
Yes, Bernard was with him.
Huh.
And he was 46 years old, just a few, mm-hmm. 2 weeks before that.
Mm-hmm.
And had worked hard all his life, never knew what it was. Mm-hmm. Never had a vacation pay. Never had a paid vacation.
So then, after he died, you decided that you were going to move down here because your family was here?
And all the family were down here.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Now, this was like during the Depression.
Huh?
This was like during the Depression, actually, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, 1930.
Now,
he died September the 20th, 1930.
Now, how was he doing during the Depression when it first started?
Well, even that you said, if he had lived, he would have suffered terribly because things were beginning to really dry up, and he had to make all these small towns, and they were beginning to feel it very much, you know.
But up until he died, he was still able to make fairly good.
Well, he was on a trip for J.S. Hoffman Company when he died.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't really feel the effects of the Depression then?
Well, yes, he felt it because there was the fear of it anyway, because things were really getting bad even when, and Joe was beginning to worry terribly because, you know, when he come in, he said, look, Joe, there's no business. What can I order him?
Mm-hmm.
No business. People don't have any money.
Would he work on commission, or did he get a salary?
No, he got a salary, but at the most he ever got was $50 a week. So he never got a big salary.
And then he had a commission on top of it?
Well, it wouldn't amount to much because he'd have to sell so much in order to get 2%.
I see.
That it didn't amount to very much.
So his salary remained the same, though, during the Depression?
Almost,
yes. He didn't have to take a salary cut?
No, he never had it. But how could they cut things? He never had much.
So you were... Economically, you did all right then during the beginning of the Depression.
Well, I won't say you did all right because, for one thing, our house was always full of people who were out of work.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how many people slept just on the floor with mm-hmm. blankets and everything, and many times they took the blanket. You don't mind if I take the blanket with me? I have none and everything. And I already felt it, you know. And Joe, when he'd come home, he had samples. He would give them to the comrades, you know, and fed them all, because his samples, you know,
mm-hmm.
even when he had to buy it, if he got it for a fraction mm-hmm. of the price, you know, and everything. See, he believed in it, but he never would want to join.
Mm-hmm.
He was very angry that he, you see, there was a poet, Dave Perkins, I have his poetry, and, you know, he had been so frustrated himself. When I met him, the Lynch, this tall guy from Iowa, he wrote a poem for me, and I got it, and he called me Davy, because during the Fort Collins, when they tried to recruit guys to go ahead and fight against the Mexico, I was telling him, don't go, this is, you know, and the captain, someone finally said, look, that little woman up there is agitating, and they came down, they would have arrested me, but Lynch had his wagon. He says, look, there's no sense in your staying here and being arrested, you know. And he brought it as a year old. So if he just picked me up, put me in, I can go away, and or I'd have been arrested that time because I was telling him not to join up. And you know, they were going after Villa and after the... So I saw that it was doing then already, you know, to people, you know. In 1930, in our home in Berkeley, it was always full of people who had no place to go. And
so you didn't, it didn't touch you personally so much as all the people?
It didn't cut, he still got enough to make our payment on the house, because... You see, what saved us when Joe died, Joe had taken out an insurance policy that if anything happened to him, the insurance would pay the rest of the house and give me the balance. Mm-hmm. So they paid Walt, and I had $3,000 besides out of it. Then we had about $6,000 insurance when the insurance happened. So I had $9,000 altogether.
Now, and that $9,000, that was what you lost in the stock market?
I lost most of it, but I retained, see, when I sold the house, I still, and I sold the house for a fraction of what it was worth, you know, but at that time it was very hard. So I kept $1,400, I had $1,400, and after I lost everything, I took $740 of that and bought 50 shares of Douglas mm-hmm. Aircraft.
Yeah, that's
exactly. And I lived on the
and
stock market ever since.
Okay.
Now, so the capital system has supported me.
Now, Barbara, when one other thing I wanted to ask you before we talk about when you first came down here. You mentioned that you dropped out of the party until 1936, that you withdrew until the children were older.
Until Carl Jean was older.
But now, nevertheless, you were working for things like the International Labor.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I was very active in the International Labor Defense.
Now, why was it all right, though, to continue in something like that?
Because I thought that this was a present need. People were in jail for holding the same opinions I had. And therefore, it was, no matter what, no matter how hard it was, that was the support that had to come to them.
Oh, but you saw the party as being more of a long range.
That's right. That's right. More of the long range and sometimes rather inadequate, too.
But so that you didn't feel that you could devote to something that was long range.
That's right.
But something like
that. That's right, of immediate concern.
I see. Okay. I wasn't clear as to why you made that decision.
Yes.
And then you moved down here and then went back up north for the surgery.
No, we never didn't move down here. I had the surgery before we moved down here. And that was disastrous because the surgeon I went to, you know, was because the doctor
was
down. Yeah, yeah.
And the surgery, you feel, was because of the abortion. That you had damaged the uterus.
Well, I hadn't damaged the uterus, but I had damaged the ligaments that held it, weakened it, so that the uterus came right out of me. Just as far as I can remember, it was like an egg-shaped thing, you know. It came right out, and I couldn't walk or anything until I went forever and pushed it back in. And so one of the doctors I'd gone to said to me, "You've got to take care of that, because the continued irritation can cause cancer."
Mm-hmm.
So that scared the wits out of me.
Oh.
And Francis is the one who made me go to the doctor right away. I was going to wait till I came down to Los Angeles, because here I had the family to take care of Carol Jean. Francis said she would stay there the whole time, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And she stayed there for 10 days, but she didn't stay longer.
Well, Barbara, when did your family move to Los Angeles?
We moved to Los Angeles in 1931.
Now, when did the other members of your own family move? Your sisters, you had a
My sister lives here. She came here. She had lived here from 1912 on.
Oh, I see.
She had lived in Los Angeles.
And were your parents dead by then?
Oh, yes, my parents. My mother was alive, but my father died in 1917.
I see.
And my mother died on New Year's Eve, 1931.
Oh, so she was here, though, when you moved down?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you
She
had
was here with my sister that had this.
I see. So you had the surgery and then moved to Los Angeles?
Yeah, we moved to 1931.
And what part of L.A. did you move to?
Well, when we first came here, we moved over on Burns Street, where the University of Southern California used to be right near there. So we moved there. Then we moved over to, I think it was 2700 Arlington,
mm-hmm.
just two blocks south of Adams Boulevard. And then, Francis, we had traded out, then we moved to Pasadena.
Mm.
And, we lived there a short time, and then we traded the house in Pasadena for the one on 1933 West 65th Street. and lived there 13 years, and here we've been almost 30 years in this damn shack.
Well, how come you moved around so much when you first came down?
Well, you see, most of the time the house was... the house in Pasadena was because of Francis. Francis had found out that some people wanted to trade the house in Pasadena, and she had a lot, she was only 20 herself, so she had a lot of trouble of herself and never looked into it. When I came down and saw what kind of a house it was, I almost died, because our house was just 5 times as much as that. And all I got was a couple of $100 in that house there, in the house.
So, when you moved down, Francis was living here.
Well,
and
yes.
Dorothy and Carol Jean were still with you at home.
Dorothy was really in Berkeley at that time. I came down with Carol Jean, but Dorothy was really in Berkeley.
She stayed up there.
Yes. Dorothy, by that time, was about 17.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been married to Lou Sherman, a brother of Bill Schneiderman.
Oh.
But it didn't last very long. He really loved her dearly.
Oh, so all three of them married very early.
Yes.
How old was she when she married?
When Dorothy?
Mm-hmm.
Dorothy was 16 when she was married.
And
almost 17, but not quite.
And Frances was?
Frances, 19. When she first married, was not quite 18.
And how old was Carol Jean when she married?
And Carol Jean was 17.
Oh, they all married very
young. Yeah. Well, Carol Jean, because the boy who... Really, I never known of anyone to love anyone like that boy loved Carol Jean. To him, he said, you know, Carol Jean to me is the sun and the moon and the stars. When she comes in, it's like a bright, shining star. I said, oh, Sammy, don't talk like that. It sounds romantic, but it isn't really. Yeah, but he really loved her too. You know, at that time, when she was 17, he was only 20. He was killed at 22.
Oh.
And before we got notice of his death, he had written to Carol Jean the last letter he had written to her. Did I tell you about that? You know, Shelley, I think it's the most beautiful letter. He said, Carol Jean, I want you to know, right now the hut where the boy who was there went on a mission yesterday and never came back. I'm going out on a mission tomorrow morning, and I don't know if I'll come back. But if oblivion comes, I want you to know that the 2 years with you were the happiest of my life and were worth all of everything. And how much I love you. I can only live through you. And if you get married and have children, which I want you to do, and when you look into their little faces, will you think of the boy who loved you so much, to whom you felt everything, and whom you made so happy for the 2 years we were together, for which I am very, very... You know, to this day it brings a tear to my eyes, because she never came back. Before she got the letter, she got the notice from them. We wanted to tell you that you were, this day we reported missing in action. He was a gun runner on the airplane.
Oh.
And one of the first ones, but that would get killed.
So one of the reasons she married so young was because of the war? Why do you think that the three girls married so young?
Well, with Carol Jean, it was because of the war. And see, Sammy was going into the war because, he was a devoted communist.
Mm-hmm.
And... it's a strange thing. Sammy, was learning very fast. I'd gone with him to Pasadena to see a friend of his and everything. And I told him to bring his friend along, to our house. He said to me, you've been so very, very good to me. Why? I said, dear, it's not because I'm such an altruist or altruistic. He says, what does altruist mean? So I was thinking, he says, I'm learning more English from you than I ever learned in school. I said, oh, no, Sammy. He said, yes, that's true. I said, well, Sammy, it's not because I went to school so much. I only went to the 7th grade, but I get a lot. If you read, after all, if you go to college afterward, a lot of the things that you get are books. But to know how to do it is very important, and in college you do learn, which I've never learned. There is a certain method of training that you get if you don't.
I'll get it covered. In other words, did all three of the girls marry communists?
Yes, I think they did, because Jim Jones was a communist.
Uh-huh.
But let me tell you something. You know Helen Travis?
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, Helen Travis was playing tennis in San Diego, and she was saying something that she'd been with Dorothy Healy and Barbara Nestor. He said, Dorothy Healy, you know, she used to be my sister-in-law. And she, yeah, he said, yes. He said, by the way, how is her mother? I often think, I thought he disliked me because I would get so angry at him and everything. But I was so amazed that he said, you know, he's become a rich man. You know what he did before? He had $3,000.
Well, Barbara, so all three of the girls, though, did marry, I mean, because Francis, James Jones was a communist. And Carol Jean, the Sammy was a communist.
Sammy was a communist.
And Dorothy's first husband, what was his name?
Lou Sherman.
And he was a communist.
Yes.
So they all...
He's the head of a union now.
So all three of them, that's interesting. Their whole life was very...
That's right.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
Now, after you came to L.A. then, when did you meet Nestor?
In 1933, we moved down to 65th Street.
Uh-huh.
And his wife came around first. And then, you know, he came to... And at that time, what he was really doing was selling from an automobile he had vegetables and things because he lost his job. He was really an unusual person. I'll show you a picture of him. He was a very handsome man, and he thought he was a communist. He really didn't know much about Marxism or anything. He had been a Tolstoyan in Bulgaria, and a very weak kind of a socialist. But he was a crackpot in many ways, you know. But you see, well, Joe was so worried about my being active. Dan thought it was the most wonderful thing. He thought that I was just remarkable, and I wasn't really. You know, he really annoyed me, because if anyone say, who can do that? He says, Barbara can do it. I said, Peggy, please stop it. It isn't true. And I hate sailing under false colors, and I don't even like it. It isn't true I couldn't do it, and I don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, I never met anyone that knew more than you do. That's because you haven't met very many people who knew very much. That's true.
When did he come from Bulgaria?
He came from Bulgaria when he was 23 years old. He ran away from the Turkish war.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to fight against Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Not because he liked Turkey. But he didn't believe in war.
Mm-hmm.
So he ran away, and he had a doctor friend in Switzerland. He went away, he says, with one penny. And he walked until hitchhiking. People in their wagons would pick him up until he came to Austria. And then someone put him up there, you know. And then he went to Switzerland and stayed with his doctor friend. Then his doctor friend made it possible for him to come. Now, his name was really Sheriff Cheev. Isn't that a horrible name? And he took his friend's passport. His friend's name was Nestor. And he came here in this country under name Nestor. Well, I didn't know any of this about him, you know. See, he came to the door, when we were living in 65th Street, to ask if I'd buy vegetables and things from him. And I said, no, I can't afford to buy from you because you have to charge a whole lot more. There's a Japanese guy at the market on Florence, who saves things for me, and much cheaper, I get them at half price. I said, he's just very, very nice to me. He says, well, but mine is the very best. I says, well, I'm not accustomed to the very best, so it's all right.
So that was the first time you met him, wasn't it?
The first time I met him. And then he began coming, and I met his wife, too, and I really liked her better than him. She was making wax and everything. She had come to this country at 18, and she was a nurse. She had a trained nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And then she also had a great ability. She manufactured a certain wax that for furniture, for anything you use, it was just perfect. She tried to sell it at the May Company,
mm-hmm.
and she went up and told them, look, for this will answer on every purpose. because Mrs. Nestor, we don't want a wax that answers every purpose. How do you think that my company would survive? We want one that's the very best of furniture, the very best of the floors, the very best of other things. Not one that does it all. What if what happens? Oh, she said, I'm glad you told me. She said, well, you sure. So then when I met him, they were already separated, although living in the same house, and they were going to get a divorce. Mm-hmm. And he had sex trouble, so she thought he was impotent and everything. But all his life he had that issue. You know, he went to doctors to find out and everything. And there was one thing I could say, as she who was full of passion, really, and she was a beautiful woman and everything, she was only frustrated, you know, and I who didn't give a hand, it made a big difference to him, and I don't know why. The first time he said he felt it was a man, and I don't know why, and I've never mentioned this to anybody, the first one, because he told me in this. And really and truly, I didn't like him very much. If he stayed too long and talked too much, you know, and I found out that although he was passionately espoused the cause of communism, he didn't really know too much about it. He had been a Tolstoyan, and he had tried to be a vegetarian, gave it up after 3 months, because he thought, well, the animals kill and eat one another, so I'm going to stop eating them? It's really foolish. So he stopped. And I think I told you that we went once to a John Reed affair, you know, and the John Reed clubs were mostly of the intellectual kind and everything. And there were some professors there. I only knew one of them. And I knew one of the doctors there, too. And they were going to have a discussion on Marx. So he said, you know, kind of cocky, I thought you were going to talk on Marx. He says, Marx, you know, Marx is kind of a great subject. What phrase of Marx? He says, well, just Marx, they're just Marx. And they looked at him, and nothing. And then they looked at me, but I only know two of them, too, you know. And I was so embarrassed. I don't know why I had to be embarrassed for him. But I sat out in the garden. They had Japanese lanterns, everything very, very arty. So he came out. I said, Pedro, what do you really know about communism? What do you know about Marx? He said, who was Marx to tell me that I had to be a wage slave until you had a developed economy? I said, you're right. Marx didn't tell you that. Quit your job today. He said, well, how will I eat? Well, that's what's telling you to keep your job, not because Marx told you. Well, then who was Marx to tell the peasants in Germany that they couldn't win because they didn't have a developed economy to carry on that? I said, are you serious? He said, of course I am. I said, but this happened 300 years before Marx was born. He merely explained why they hadn't won, not because he told them they couldn't win. He only explained, I don't think you know anything about Marx. You don't know anything about Marx. He says, what do I have to know about it? Well, there is quite a philosophy about it. I said, but you ought to know something about it. So he was discussing something that someone, you know, had said, show the face of the party and everything, you know. So Doris, and he said something that was really a little foolish, and I can't remember just but Doris, he said, Frederick, what did you ever read of Marx? He said, well, not very much, but I read something. So they mentioned one thing you read of Marx. Well, when you came right down to it, it's only what you heard. I really didn't know very much about it. And I was just dumbfounded. So, you see, Catherine Mayer's book on India had come out just a short time before that. And we'd gone down to one of these forums, mm-hmm. and they had said if anyone had read the book, who had read the book? I was the only one who had read the book. So they said, would you give us just very briefly, because I'm not a reviewer or anything, but I'll tell you what she said. But I want to tell you when I close that a son of Mother India answers Catherine, and this is what he says. if I were to come down here and write a book about America, and if I were to tell you that I saw people eating out of garbage cans in New York, it would be true. If I were to tell you that I went down south and saw that black people, just because their kin skins were dark, and they had contributed to the whole economy and the culture of the country, that when they were treated worse than animals, it would be true, but give me the whole history of Catherine Mayer went to, but she didn't say, when she told you all the things that were the inadequacy, she didn't tell you that England had been there for 300 years. And what did England ever do to raise the cultural quality of the Indian people, except to take everything they could out of them so that England subsisted on the backs of the Indians there? Well, you see, having been the only one who had done it, it made a hit, you see. And so Dan thought, see, you were the only one. I said, it just happened to be that in that group, I was the only one who had read the book. It had just come out. And the only reason I read it is Frances had worked at the library, and as soon as the book came out, she could all, they, anyway, and she brought it right over to us. And that's the reason I had read it, for that reason. But the Son of Mother India Answers had come out a little bit, not very much later, because otherwise I couldn't have connected it. But he did. He annoyed me so much, you know, because it's really nauseating to have anyone else say, she can do this, and it isn't true.
Well, how come you decided to marry him, Barbara?
How could I what?
How come you decided to marry him?
Well, you see, when he came, I didn't decide at first. I didn't even like him. One time I hid for 2 hours in the clothes closet and told my sister to tell him I wasn't home. And I couldn't come out for that length, and I thought, God damn him all. If he doesn't go quick, I'll die here. And he finally went. But he kept on coming, and I didn't know he knew so little. I thought really that he was so devoted to movement. And then, you see, he adored everything I did, you know. He thought it was so wonderful. Joe had been always in such a worry that it was a kind of comfort to have someone who admired what I did instead of continuing to be critical of it, you know. And before I knew it, then he told me, you know, I had never met anyone with everything. And I said, well, see, he thought he was a kind of a poet, because when he first met Frida, he wrote a poem. He said, I looked up at the polar star and knew that happiness was not afar. And that was about as far as his poetry went. So he admired these things. He admired our poets and everything. But he really had an inadequate say. But anyway, you know, but he did love all the children. He loved Ricky. He loved all of the kids, you know, and loved all of my grandchildren. And he really loved them.
Yeah,
oh yes, mm-hmm. They liked him, because he really liked them.
Now,
but you see,
Carol was very young still, wasn't she?
Carol was at that time 7 years old, and I'll tell you, when he came, we weren't married for almost 3 years after he came. But then I have a friend who was one of the heads in the social service, and she said, you know, Barbara, I want to warn you that right now with all that's going on, they can take Charlene away from you, that you're contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Well, then when I heard that, you know, then I said, you have to be married. I can't, you know, can't let it. I wouldn't want to, I said, I'd much sooner leave you than her. So.
But by this time, then, you didn't really believe in marriage anymore.
Not very much, No, not very much, because I could see, you know, the one thing, it was so shallow, that I promised to love, honor, and cherish, or love, honor, and obey, as long as we live. I thought that was kind of silly. Even in biblical times, look, they were always losing their partners and living with Abraham, go ahead and throw the mother of his son out, and then, of course, they had Isaac at 90 years of age, and he was 100. Silly, wasn't it? So, and they all had more than, at the first thing, I don't know whether they called them concubines or what, but you know, they never had a rabbi to marry them. They just lived together, too.
If it wasn't for this social service thing, you probably would not have actually gotten married then.
Probably not. Mm-hmm. But this scared the wits out of me, because to lose Carol Jean would have been...
So you started, he started living with you once in about 1932, and then...
1933, I think it was.
And 1933. 1936?
Yes. You married just before we rejoined the party.
Now, had he been a member of the
no,
party?
No, he hadn't. He joined it at that time.
But he would be involved in all the other activities that you...
He was not involved in very much more than most that he could do, and he didn't do that well, was to help distribute the People's World. Mm-hmm. He went once, when I was sick, he went with the People's World, and he found a black woman that he had known in San Diego. Then he just, for 3 months, he had worked at a, trying to study to be an electrician, and he met her. And he said, oh, I haven't seen you so long. How are you? And he said, are you working? She said, no, I'm unemployed. She said, give me your address now, because we know people who want a maid. Well, you know, to black people, to tell them that she reported him to the party, you know, and they were going to bring him up on charges. And they came and told Dorothy, what kind of a thing is this, then? And everything. And, oh, she was so furious, she could have killed him. And Dorothy said, look, what are you going to bring him on charge? He's a fool. He doesn't know very much. But it's only a mistake of ignorance. Nothing of the intent or anything else. He doesn't know. You know that he does whatever you tell him, but he really doesn't know very much. How are you going to bring him up on charge? Isn't that a fool? So they didn't bring him up on charge.
But he was a rather good-natured person.
In some respects, he was good-natured. And I'll tell you what he did once. When Ricky was only about 2.5 years old, he liked to, I'll tell you what, he liked to tease. Which I always thought anyone who really liked to tease anyone was the kind of, I thought they were showing the sign of cruelty too. So when we were walking, see, he was almost 6 feet tall, and you know, I'm a shrimp. So he'd go with his knee like this, and I said, stop that, I don't like it. He said, I like it. I said, well, but I'm on the receiving end and I don't like it. If you do it again, I'll kick you. He said, you wouldn't do that. I said, you'd be surprised to know what I can do when I get angry. So he did it again and I kicked him. He says, Bobby, you really hurt me. I said, well, a kick was never meant to be a kiss. And if you do it again, I'll kick you so hard you won't know what struck you. He said, Bobby, you have a savage temper. I said, that's only a mild example of it, Frederick. You don't know what I could do. So he never did it again. But with Ricky, he did the same thing, you know, pushing him like that. And Ricky said, stop it, Grandpa. He called him Grandpa, stop it. And he did it again. So Ricky kicked him. And, you know, he slapped the kid on his blind side that you saw the mark of his hand on. And I was so curious when I saw that. To hit Ricky. You see, with Dorothy, I had made up my mind when she left. See, when the head of the union came and said that they needed Dorothy, and Ricky was only 8 months old then, she said, I can't leave Richard. So he came and said, Barbara, will you take care of the baby? She said, you know, right now, how many in the labor movement can we trust? But Dorothy is one that even the phonies trust her. So will you do it? I said, of course I will. So I took care of Ricky.
When was that, Barbara? When was he born?
Then Ricky was born in 1943. So when Pedro slapped him like that across his behind, I was so furious. I had been wiping some dish, and so with the dishcloth, I stuck it across his face. He said, you almost took out my eye with that. I said, I'll take out some more of you than that. I said, if you ever do that again, said you, believe me, you either leave the house forever, or I'll start to say you'll never, you'll know that you never better do it again, because you really are a sadist, that's what you are. How can you go? He said, well, he kicked me first. I said, so you're getting reason with it. He kicked you first. He kicked you because you were tormenting and teasing him. How does a man do? I said, you know, kid, you're not only a sadist, but you're a fool. And that, see, the Jews saying that every sickness you can cure, but you can't cure a fool of his foolishness because he doesn't even know, he doesn't know anything. So don't ever do it again. And he did the same thing with Carol Jean. Carol Jean was 7, as I say, and he was climbing a orange tree, and he said, go and jump over this. Carol Jean was jumping around to see what she could have, and she jumped over the mound that he had, and he said, don't do it. She says, why? I'm careful. I won't get any of the mud in there. And she jumped over it, and he went and struck her. And she cried, although she was fond of him. I said, if you ever do that again, Fedya, you'll go out on your ear so fast you won't know what struck you. If Joe could know that anyone else was striking his child, to him, Carol Jean was very, very precious. I think he would go back to, he would die.